And those who are here on time and appreciate that. First thing we need to do is, and I'd like to do this before we even move on to introductions, is just adopt our committee rules. We have really just standard set of rules here. Don't know that there's any issues of concern to anyone.
Chairman, I move that we adopt the proposed House Committee on Rules and Public Affairs.
Thank you. Adopted by Representative Berger. Any discussion adopting the rules? No objection. Rules are adopted. Now, introduction of members. Again, want to welcome you and appreciate the fact that you are here with us and going to be with us during the long haul. I anticipate that we will have some issues to be dealing with prior to end of session, and we will kind of take them as they come. I've looked at, I think, some different categories, and certainly elections issues will be first and on the forefront. But we also recognize that there's a number of members still trying to get legislation drafted. And my goal is that we're going to be able to kind of compartmentalize these issues as much as possible. So, you know, we're going to be able to take as much election reform together as we can and as we go through other issues as well. I'm also hoping that you will at least be able to identify kind of a rolling two-week agenda up until probably end of April. And at that point, you know, we know as committees start shutting down elsewhere that our work is going to intensify and that we'll have, you know, a little bit more harried schedule. But, you know, while we're in those first few months, I think that we can look at this in a pretty organized way. I'm not going to tax your time, knowing that we will be spending a lot of time together towards the end anyway. And with that, you know, just kind of some opening comments on my choices, where I want to move, at least how we organize ourselves. And so with that, I'd also like to introduce Representative Bill Barnhart, a member of our committee, Representative Betsy Close, Representative Lori Monitz Anderson is one of our vice chairs, who will be joining us shortly, and Representative Joanne Berger, Representative Vic Backlund, and Representative Linda Flores, who's another one of our vice chairs. And we have our two members of committee administration, Kara Filsinger, coming back for an encore performance as administrator of the Rules Committee. Is very pleased that we were able to get her help through this next few months, and very pleased to have Annetta Mullins as our committee assistant. So there's a lot of great opportunities for us, and I certainly encourage, as we go through these issues, that if there's any concerns you have, I mean, please don't hesitate to voice those concerns, and we're happy to do what we can to keep the process moving forward. So I'm also looking to kind of jump our schedule a little bit. You see on the agenda a work session for possible introduction of committee bills. And we did have three different committee bills that basically has just been requested to be introduced only. As all of you know, as veterans of at least one session, except for our one vice chair here, is that introduction of committee bills does not necessarily imply any voice of approval or commitment to that bill's contents. It's strictly, you know, that we're going to be able to introduce it for legislative council and then have it be routed through the process. Representative Flores, can you introduce our committee bills?
Well, in that regard, then, Mr. Chair, I move the Legislative Council drafts number 694, 695, 696 to be introduced as committee bills.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Flores. Any objection? Okay, seeing none, the bills are introduced. I mentioned before that we are going to spend some time on elections issues, and one of the things that has come through the federal process has been the Help America Vote Act of 2002. It was passed by Congress and signed by President Bush, and pretty much on the in the wake of all the voting issues that came about in the 2000 election. And what we are hoping for today is just to get an overview of that law, what the state's requirements are going to be, where some of the latitude that the state has in dealing with these changes in law. And really, I mean, just what are those expectations? And I wanted to give you that kind of introduction. We'll kind of see where that discussion takes us to determine at that point whether we're looking for opening up a hearing on 2145 with that work session. But, you know, we'll just kind of see how that goes. But for now, I'd like to introduce John Lindback, our elections manager, for some comments about the Voters Act.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'd like to introduce Lynn Rosick from the State Department of Justice, who is the lawyer that advises us on elections issues. She's gone through the bill in great detail and received some training on it, as well as I have, and two of the other managers in my office. I had a chance to speak briefly with the chair about this bill last week and told him that it was a very complicated piece of legislation. It's 162 pages long, and it's just one of those federal bills that's very difficult to read because it's not necessarily logical in the way that it's written in the progression of things. So it requires a lot of jumping back and forth. And frankly, federal legislation is relatively new to those of us who work in the elections business. Most of us have worked mainly with state election laws, and incorporating a large federal bill like this into our business has been a somewhat daunting and complicated task, and we're trying to take it one step at a time. But what I thought I'd do for you today is take you through the highlights of the bill and sort of give you an example or show you the depth and breadth of this legislation. It's really quite large in terms of the amount of territory that it covers. As Chairman Doyle pointed out, the bill in many respects is a reaction to what happened in the 2000 election in Florida. And it took 2 years to get this legislation through Congress. The sort of centerpieces of the bill involve improvements to voting systems and elections administration, and then there are other provisions thrown in. And when you get to when you talk about the improvements to voting systems and elections administration, the centerpiece of that is the elimination of punch cards and punch card voting systems in the United States. In Oregon, we still have three counties on punch cards: Washington, Clackamas, and Lane, which comprise about one-third of the voters in Oregon. It also talks about improvements to voter access and really provides something that's never been provided for in federal law, and that is a requirement on the states that voters with disabilities be able to vote in a private manner, just like folks without a disability can. Right now, if you have certain disabilities and you need assistance in voting, in Oregon, the counties will send out someone or two people to help you, and they will assist you with marking your ballot and voting it. And what we have to get to in Oregon is the same as every other state will have to get to, and that is providing technology to people with disabilities that will allow them to cast their vote in private without assistance. And I'll get into some of the technicalities of that a little bit later in this presentation. There's also provisions concerning Native Americans and Alaska Natives and non-English proficient citizens. And there are provisions that address sort of the integrity of voter registration. And that's where we get into the requirement on each state that we implement a centralized voter registration system. Now, some of you are familiar with that issue because the legislature passed a bill on that in the last regular session. This legislation includes some interesting wording, which I will show you later on in the slides, and a deadline, and it says that we have to do it. And it also says that we have to do it whether or not the federal government provides any money for it. The signs are good that they're going to provide money, up to 95% of the cost. But if that sort of fell through, that federal requirement would still be there, and we would somehow have to construct the system without any federal assistance. There are also new identification requirements for voters who choose to register to vote through the mail. And we'll go into that in a little bit more detail as well. There's voter education and outreach provisions in the bill. We will have to provide election materials to our voters describing any changes we make in our voting systems. We have to inform them about the new identification requirements if they're registering through the mail. We have to provide information to the voters on how to make sure their ballot is counted and how to get a replacement ballot if they make a mistake on their ballot. All of that is a very important part of the legislation. It's very important to Oregon because our folks are voting at home, and so we are going to have to, under the provisions of this bill, be able to show folks that we've done a good job of providing voter education. And we have to provide outreach to voters with disabilities and non-English proficient citizens, and there are also provisions under this bill for programs to involve high school and college students, and I'll go into those in a little bit more detail as well. There's a fraud prevention section, and there are sections dealing with ballot access to military and overseas voters. So I'll go into the different titles of the bill for you so you can see sort of how it's organized. Title I provides for payments to states for elections administration improvements and the replacement of punch card and lever voting machines. In these provisions, they will provide to each state approximately $4,000 for each precinct, for each precinct in the 2000 election in which there was punch card voting. Under our formula, that will qualify Oregon for approximately $2.3 million in funding under this bill. That would be money that would go to the counties for replacement of punch card systems. In the 2000 election, we had 7 counties that voted on punch cards. 4 of them have already replaced their punch card systems, and there are the remaining 3 that I talked about earlier. The 4 that have already replaced their systems would be eligible for reimbursement under this bill. And that $2.3 million would include money for reimbursement. Yes. Okay.
John, when you make comment that it's going to the counties for the purpose of these, right. I guess, changing the system, is there a requirement that it actually goes to those changes, or, you know, will counties basically have an option to decide they want to keep the punch card system and they're not going to make the change, but they're going to keep the money?
It is characterized, and Lynn can correct me on this if I'm wrong, but it is characterized by the folks who adopted this bill as an incentive to replace punch cards. But part of the stick in the bill is that if one county doesn't do it, then the rest won't get the money either. So there is an incentive for all the counties who are on punch cards to replace, and it is our understanding that all of the counties in Oregon do want to replace punch cards and plan to do so under this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Sure, Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But there is a waiver available until January 2004. Is that correct?
There is, under provisions of the bill, they need to replace their punch card systems by 2004. Did I forget, Lynn, is there a waiver that says it?
Yes, I believe, and there are different waivers for different requirements, and so I may be confused here, but Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I believe that if it's not possible to have the machines all in place by 2004, I think you can waive out to 2006.
Okay, thank you.
There was an original goal to have everybody ready by the next presidential election, but because of the lateness both of the bill and the fact that no money has been appropriated yet, that it's probably likely that the entire country will not be able to convert off punch cards fast enough.
I have a quick follow-up. Could you just address the unfunded mandates issue? It's my understanding that they could not do a mandate that was unfunded. And you mentioned that that you would have to do it regardless whether there was funding or not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, I'm not familiar. I know that there are some federal laws that where they attempt to have the same theory that Oregon has, that we don't do unfunded mandates. But this bill does not waive any of the requirements if there are not appropriations. But Congress, you know, has said that they are committed to do the appropriation, and we're certainly expecting it. The states, of course, have to keep the pressure on to make sure that appropriation does happen, and they are doing so.
Thank you.
Representative Monica Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding the counties that have already converted, is that money then stipulated that it has to go to the Elections Division, or can the county backfill anything that they want to with the money that they'll
be getting? It has to be spent for punch cards and the elimination of your punch card system and replacing it with another system.
Mr. Chair, yes. But you said that there were 3,000 precincts that are out of the 6,000 or 7,000 that have already made the change, yet you said they would still be able to get the money. And I wanted to know the money that will be going there, will it be going to the Elections Division?
Well,
you see what I'm saying? They've already paid for it, so it's already out of their budget, so...
Well, one of the things that I'm going to tell you a little bit more about later on in this presentation is that in order to get any money under this bill, we have to adopt a state elections plan. And part of the plan will involve setting up the rules by which the counties receive that money and what they can spend it on. And our intent certainly is to make sure that any money, you know, it all comes to the state first, through the election fund that we'll talk to you a little bit about in this legislation, and then it would go from the election fund to the counties, and it's our job as the administrators here to make sure that the money is spent to replace punch card systems only, and we're going to be subject to federal audits on that as well. So
let me head to my side.
Okay, let's continue.
Go on. Title I provides for all the payments to the states for the replacement of punch card and lever voting machines. Title II establishes a National Elections Assistance Commission, which is, they're sort of taking some of the functions that are now residing with the Federal Elections Commission and setting up a new agency that's going to be in charge of overseeing the implementation of this bill and working with the states. It's going to have equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats and, you know, sort of the proper mix. And they will have specific responsibilities, and those responsibilities are outlined in Title II. Title III allows for all of those non-discriminatory election technology and administration requirements, and what that phrase means is that's all the requirements for the voters with disabilities. Title IV deals with the various enforcement provisions of the bill. There's a Help America Vote College program in Title V and money authorized specifically for that. There's the Help America Vote Foundation in Title VI. And then Title VII deals with voting rights of military members and overseas citizens. And they have various sections in that in which some things are optional, some things are required, and I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. There are some transition provisions in Title VIII and in Title IX, some more miscellaneous stuff. In Title I, on the Elections Administration Assistance Improvements, it will provide payments to the states for the following, complying with the Title III requirements, which in Title III you'll find things like centralized voter registration systems, for example. And it will provide, under Title I, it provides payments for that. all those things I talked about earlier, the general improvement of elections administration, educating voters, training, replacing voting systems, improving access to the voting process, and establishing toll-free hotlines for reporting fraud and for information on voter registration systems. It requires the states to replace the punch cards by November 2004. Title I guarantees each state a minimum of $5 million. What we are looking at so far, under the total authorization, by our calculations, Oregon could be eligible for up to $32 million under this bill. If they do not appropriate all that's authorized, of course, that would go proportionally down depending on what they appropriate. Title I authorizes $650 million in payments, $325 million for elections administration, $325 million for the replacement of those voting systems that I talked about, and it establishes that national commission to carry out the grant programs, issue the guidelines for the voting systems, test and certify voting systems, which is a very important part of what they will do. That has now been in the hands of the National Association of State Elections Directors, and our group has been doing a pretty good job with that. This will lend a whole lot more formality and federal oversight to that process than has been there before. They'll be studying various elections issues, and they will carry out the Help America Vote Act College program. They'll also be establishing a standards board and board of advisors to review voluntary voting systems guidelines and best practices. There's going to be two representatives from each state on that board. And it provides states with the funding to meet the Act's requirements. Now, what they placed as authorization in the bill was $3 billion nationwide. That $27 to $30 million for Oregon was an earlier estimate. As I mentioned earlier, we have seen it revised too. It requires the creation of a state elections fund, which is in the bill that's on your agenda for discussion today. And it requires each state to do a state plan for implementing the Help America Vote Act. And that plan must address all, of course, the requirements in the bill. The Secretary of State has appointed an advisory committee to work on that plan. We have representatives from counties, representatives from our office. Representative Doyle has agreed to serve on the committee along with Senator Elect Schrader. And we have the League of Women Voters and a couple of other stakeholder groups as members of the committee. And they are working with other Oregonians on specific sections of the plan. And that plan has to be done before we can get certain parts of the funding under this bill. And so we're working expeditiously to have a draft of that plan out as soon as possible, and work is well underway. The grant programs provide all of these different sources of money for various different things. You can see that at least on paper, it looks generous and unprecedented in terms of the kind of money that the federal government is willing to put into election systems. It's almost mind-boggling for those of us who work in elections to look at figures like this, because we've rarely seen those. Title III.
Well, just have you go back there, John, just to interrupt on the...
I'm not sure if I know how to go back.
Okay, that's all right.
you have your sheet, though, in front of you.
The grant programs, have you done any kind of brainstorming on how we could access the dollars that are dedicated for increasing polling place access? I mean, how would that work with vote-by-mail system?
Well, let's give that an example. That's, for example, is a provision that relates to folks with disabilities. And obviously, polling place access is not an issue for us. But under the disability section of the bill, what we're talking about are DREs, or direct recording voting devices. and they're touch screens, for those of you who may have never seen one, and the technology is getting pretty good on these, and they have portable ones, complete with earphones, and other kinds, using other kinds of technology that allows folks with disabilities to vote privately using this kind of technology. And some of them are portable. So instead of two people going to someone, a voter with a disability, and coming to your house, and then you sort of signaling to them somehow to the best of your ability how you want them to mark the ballot for you, you are able to operate this machine yourself and do it in private, and that machine could actually be brought to your home. And that's the kind of scenario we're talking about under that section in the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative.
I have a question about that. So are you thinking in terms of, because I think the technology is definitely there, more advanced than just voting for people with disabilities. However, you're talking about an in-home service to every disabled Oregonian. And that is almost overwhelming to me in concept. Would you like to just address that?
Well, I'm not sure it necessarily has to be an in-home service for every disabled voter in Oregon, because some of them can mark the ballot by themselves. But for those who don't and now request assistance, some of them are already receiving assistance from their counties. In other words, if you called Coos County and said, I'm a disabled voter, I need assistance marking my ballot, the clerk's office there would send two people out to your home to help you vote, and they would do that now. What would be different is that instead of them telling you how they want to vote and in essence losing the secrecy of their ballot, they'd be able to use this new technology so that the secrecy of their ballot is maintained.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do you have any idea of how many people would require such a service?
Well, that's one of the things we're sort of struggling with in the course of working on this plan. We don't yet. What we've talked about in the steering committee that's working on the plan is a minimum of two of these machines per county. Now, some of the larger counties will need and want more. And the plan that we're producing so far, at least, allows for that.
Okay. Proceed. Anything else?
Okay. Title III, the Election Technology and Administration Requirements. There's a ballot error correction opportunity that some of you may have heard about in this bill. For those folks in those states where they vote at the polling place, if you put your ballot through an optical scanning machine, they have precinct counters there, and let's say that you voted twice in a race and you're only supposed to, you know, for two candidates, and you're only supposed to vote for one, under this bill, that it would be required that you use technology that would basically tell the voter that they made a mistake in marking their ballot and allow them the opportunity to correct their ballot. Now, the way this bill is written, it says that if you're a vote by mail, if you're using vote by mail or for absentee voting, you have to provide voter education. You have to tell the voters in advance of voting how to check their ballot to make sure no mistakes were made, and if they have made an error on checking their ballot, how to request a replacement ballot and receive it. And so that's the section of the bill that's important to Oregon, obviously, since we're all vote by mail. We'll be covering this ballot error correction opportunity through voter education efforts.
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know in Lane County, one of those abysmally behind the eight ball counties, the last ballot I received had a pamphlet that came with it that included a method for correcting the ballot without asking for a replacement. Is that an alternative within this bill, or is the only, or within this law, is there only solution a replacement ballot?
Well, if there's a method of correcting it, that will be fine. Without requesting a replacement, that will be fine. It doesn't say you have to have a replacement ballot. But In most cases, you will. And I think when Lane will be switching to optical scan, and they're going to need under an optical scan system to educate voters on how to request a replacement ballot.
I see. Thank you.
Okay.
And I assume that's then we're going to have a guarantee that Lane County will no longer be behind the eight ball. Oh, those elections at least.
I'll let Lane County speak for themselves. Okay. There's also a requirement that any voting system...
Just a moment. Yes, sound close.
Yes. Can you tell me on the voter education money, you talked about educating voters to be able to vote. Would there be other uses of the money for voter education? What would those be?
Well, the folks working on the plan are coming up with that. But, including how to register. If you're registering through the mail, what identification is required now under this new bill. Those are two examples. And when we have our draft plan, we'll make sure you all get a copy so that you can see all of the other ideas that are in there.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Close.
Might any of that money be used for initiative petition signature verification?
No.
Thank you.
See.
Number two under this section talks about voting systems that your voting system has to be able to produce a paper record with a manual audit capacity. I think what they were worried about here was various kinds of voting systems where that are getting more and more electronic, and they worried about the ability to manually audit those votes. So they wanted to make sure that the folks didn't get too out there with some of these new voting systems that are coming along. They're requiring one voting machine per polling place that's accessible to people with disabilities. And so in Oregon, I described to you that scenario where we would have at least two per county. In other states, what the bill really says is you have to have one of these touchscreen voting machines at every polling place available for folks with disabilities. There's an alternative language accessibility section, and it also talks about error rates and compliant we have to make sure that our voting systems, that the error rates that we use are in compliance with the federal standards, which this new commission set up under this bill will be addressing. Under Title III, we have to have a uniform definition of a legal vote for each voting method. That's a direct response to what happened in Florida in the year 2000 and the arguments that the standards differed from county to county. We've already done this in Oregon. We have that outlined in our Vote by Mail manual. This is nothing new for us. It also requires provisional voting. For those of you that are not familiar with that term, that means if you are not on the voter rolls, they have to allow you to cast a ballot anyway, and then after Election Day, the voter, the elections officials can make a final determination on whether that was just a mistake or that person is indeed eligible to vote. They vote a different kind of ballot called provisional, and what that means is your eligibility is in question, and the elections officials will be able to take the time after Election Day to try and figure out why and whether or not you are indeed eligible to vote. We already have a provisional voting section in law. We're already compliant with this. It requires, as I said before, centralized voter registration and verification. We've started that project, and I'm looking forward to giving you folks an update on where we are with that project as part of this process. And then there are new provisions for voter identification when registering through the mail, and that's new for Oregon. We've already put those into effect, and the counties are enforcing those.
Okay. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to point number eight, when you say centralized voter registration and verification now, is that a network system, county to county throughout the state then?
And well, Later on in the presentation, I'll show you the actual language from the bill, because it's an amazing list of adjectives used to describe this. But what it really comes down to is that it has to be a state system that is accessible to all the elections officials throughout the state. So we're really not... We have talked in the past about linking all the existing county systems. That's not going to work under the provisions of this bill, and under the language, you'll see why. So we have to build a system that's centralized under the authority of the chief elections official of the state, according to the bill. And in Oregon, that's the Secretary of State.
So then that does not mean it connects each county elections office, or it does?
Well, each county will be connected to the system.
To the state system.
And it has to be a real-time system so that they can get in there and look right away to determine, for example, if they have a question, if somebody registers to vote, are they registered in Multnomah? Are they registered twice? They'll be able to look in their system and determine that right away.
One more question. Thank you. And then does it go outside the state for the same type of information or simply within Oregon?
There's no requirement in the federal bill, and they did actually discuss this, that all of the state systems be allowed to communicate with each other. And that was taken out of the bill, I think, because there was testimony given to Congress about how technologically difficult that would be to achieve. So, no, there is no requirement at that point.
Okay. Representative Bonhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you describe briefly the requirements for voter identification and registering through the mail?
Okay, if under this bill, and before you can vote in a federal election, or in order to vote in a federal election, and if you are registering through the mail, you must provide some sort of ID that shows your name and address. And so with your voter registration card, most people will probably provide their driver's license. If they don't have a driver's license, the bill specifically allows you to provide something like a pay stub or a utility bill, but something in which we can match the name and address against the name and address on the voter registration card. Here's that list of adjectives, Representative Flores. Your question about a centralized voter registration system. It has to be a single, uniform, official, interactive, centralized, computerized, statewide voter registration database to ensure accurate lists. There needs to be a unique identifier for every voter. We have to be able to coordinate it with other state databases. In other words, verify. What we hope to get to is a system, for example, where when you register to vote, instead of having to provide that ID, if you provide your driver's license number instead of the copy of the ID, then we can verify that driver's license number with DMV and take care of the ID requirement in that way. But until we have centralized voter registration in place, we have to require the actual copy of an ID. It has to provide immediate access and data entry capability for any election official, and I think that gets to your question about, you know, how are they all linked? And we have to maintain clean and accurate lists. The centralized voter registration has to allow eventually for use of the driver's license number or the last four digits of the Social Security number or a unique identifier. We'll be mulling that over in the course of doing the plan and exactly how we want to do that and what legislation that would take and what we would bring to the legislature on that issue. And again, it has to allow for sharing of database information with ID. And here are the provisions I just talked about with voter identification, so I won't repeat those. But the registration forms, actually, I didn't tell you this, have to ask about age and citizenship and inform the registrant to provide proper identification of registering through the mail. In enforcement, there is civil action against states in order to carry out provisions of Title III. They can take us to court civilly. But it also requires states receiving funds under HAVA to establish an administrative complaint procedure related to requirements of the bill. Now, the various congressional staff people who have given presentations at trainings about this bill tell us that number two on this slide really is our was a compromise in Congress, that these administrative complaint procedures were adopted rather than giving folks what they called a private right of action, in other words, the ability to sue us over any single provision of this bill. And they said, they told all the elections officials in the room, believe us, you want this. Otherwise, you'll be in federal court all the time, and we didn't want that to happen to you. So each state is required to establish an administrative complaint procedure so that people have a way of providing complaints to the chief elections official about issues related to this particular bill.
Okay. Representative Berger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, as elected people, we all want everybody to vote.
Yeah.
And so our focus is to get more people to vote.
Right.
I wonder if you think there will be some concern about so much identification and so much connection of ID in my part of Oregon. A lot of people say, if I have to tell them all that to prove who I am, then I'm not going to vote. So any comments on that?
Yeah, well, actually, your sentiment was the sentiment of our two senators. Senators Wyden and Smith both fought these provisions very hard. But, you know, it was like any piece of legislation that goes through Congress, there are a lot of compromises made. And so one of the compromises, actually, that Senator Wyden and Senator Smith worked on was the ability to do this verification of a number, for example, a DMV number, between our centralized voter registration system and our DMV system, so that it would make that whole process of providing ID less complicated. And that was one of the compromises in the bill. But, you know, I do think it's certainly possible that these ID requirements could intimidate some people out of registering to vote. We'll just have to see.
Last comment, and that is that I think that what they're trying to do is to be sure that people who are dead are not voting. And so but in Oregon, people look at it a little bit differently.
Yeah.
Thank you, though.
Yes, I agree with you, and we made that point. And what we were told was they just want to make sure you're not dead or a dog. Okay. All right.
Okay, go ahead.
So that's the administrative complaint procedure. Title V provides $5 million to encourage colleges to college students to volunteer as co-workers, and that, you know, we won't see any of that money ourselves here in Oregon, but that would be sort of a national program. And Title VI establishes a nonprofit foundation and provides $5 million to encourage high school students to volunteer as co-workers. We don't, in Oregon, those provisions don't mean as much to us since we don't have polling places and we don't have the huge problem that they have in other places. Okay. with their inability to get poll workers to show up. Title VII, military and overseas voters. It calls for the designation of a single state office to provide information on absentee ballots. That would be our office. It provides an optional provision recommending states accept absentee ballots in one location, and it requires states to submit absentee ballot report following general elections so that that they actually know how many people are out there receiving absentee ballots, and they seem particularly interested in the military and overseas voter. And it extends the period covered by single absentee ballot application to two general elections. We already have that in Oregon. That's nothing new for us. But in a lot of states, it's just one, and so those people have to provide that application for every single general election. It prohibits the refusal of voter registration and absentee ballot applications on the grounds of early submission for militaries and overseas citizens, and it requires states to provide those voters with a reason when their absentee ballot request is denied. So they're telling us we need to provide better information to those people when we deny their requests. And Title VIII is the transition provisions, which just transfer powers.
Yes. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any kind of a receipt requirement? Receiving the fact that they received an absentee ballot from you?
No, not that I've ever heard.
So an individual voter wouldn't necessarily know that his or her ballot had actually gotten in.
That's right. Unless they can either email or call that elections office, they could confirm it that way.
Oh, that's true. Thank you.
Title IX, the miscellaneous provisions. This is where we get into all those issues with receiving funds under HAVA to comport with sound accounting practices. We've all been warned we're going to be audited. Make sure you account for every single dollar, that you have auditors involved in the establishment of your plan, and so on. I'd like to talk in the final two slides, though, about the required components of a state plan, since we're working on that, and you'll be seeing a draft of that fairly shortly. We have to talk about how the state will meet the Title III requirements, how the payments will be distributed to counties, if we are going to distribute them to counties, beyond the punch card money, how state will provide voter education and elections official poll worker training, how we will adopt voting system guidelines and processes, how we will establish that elections fund we were talking about, and descriptions of the complaint process that we talked about, all must be part of the plan. We have to describe our proposed replacement of punch cards. We have to give a budget. We have to talk about how the state will adopt performance goals, how we're going to conduct ongoing management of the plan, and we have to tell them how the plan was developed. So, I don't know if I made it under 30 minutes. I tried. But
I think, given the questions that were asked, I think you did real well.
Okay.
And I really feel sorry for Fred Neal, all the work he's going to have to do. Not get any help to do it.
Well, you can feel sorry for others, too.
Any other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. My question doesn't reference the details of the act. I think you went through that, and I understand that. We also met in Representative Doyle's office one day. I'm just wondering if this act would be another demonstration that the principle of federalism is not alive and well. Originally, voting requirements were left up to the states, and only the states, and now we have a very comprehensive federal law telling the states all kinds of things. Would anyone care to comment on that? Is federalism no longer alive and well in this country of ours?
You want me to comment?
Sure.
Yeah, well, I certainly would agree with that. I think, as I mentioned earlier, that most of this bill is a reaction to what happened in Florida in 2000 and the Bush versus Gore court case, in which there was a very clear case made that there needed to be more uniformity in how voters were treated from one precinct to the next, from one county to the next, and from one state to the next. And I think this is an effort to bring more uniformity to the process.
And as I read the at least portions of this act that I've been able to get through, Lynn, although there are elements that the states are required to comply with, there's not a requirement to accept the money that goes with that kind of compliance. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that's true, though I don't know of any state that is planning on declining the money. I'd make one more point to follow up on Representative Backlund's point. The bill, if you look at it closely, ties all of these requirements to federal elections. So theoretically, you do not have to do any of these things for strictly state and local elections. But as a practical matter, when the exact same system is used for every election, it's like the other federal laws that relate to elections, like the National Voter or NAVRA, the Motor Voter Law, which only also applies to federal elections, but you would have to have two completely different, parallel, very expensive systems in order to maintain your state's right of having your own system. So there's no thought, I think, on the part of any state that they're going to just do this only for the federal elections.
Mm-hmm.
of which we ordinarily only have two in every 2 year cycle.
And I think to follow up a little bit on Representative Close's concerns on the mandates issue, if we go forward with some of these and basically trying to comply with the federal statutes, and yet, you know, we don't get the funding to do that, and yet we're now starting to impose state mandates, are we not, on the counties, on how they're to be complying? I mean, is there a way to that you see that we can protect ourselves if we end up not getting the financial resources from the federal government, since, you know, we don't have any assurances that the money's actually going to come to, I think, comply with our own Oregon's law on mandating things to the local entities?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's a good question, although I believe, if my recollection is correct as to the provision in the Constitution on mandates to the local government, that it exempts federal requirements. So I think we probably, but that in no way implies, of course, that we're expecting that the counties are going to pay for all these things without federal money. The expectation is, and I think Congress is committed to appropriating at some level, the question will be how soon and will it be enough, given the other budgetary concerns that they have at this point.
Well, and I guess my only caution would be that as we are looking into, you know, the different laws that we're going to have to be developing to conform to this act, that it is actually continuing to be couched in the terms that it is trying to conform to the federal law. It's not something that we're kind of going off on our own saying, gee, you know, let's do it under the auspices of this act, even though the act doesn't tell us we have to. Any other questions, comments? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious as to what our voting system is going to look like after the transition, and especially I'm thinking about what functions are going to be performed by the Secretary of State's office and what functions are going to be performed somewhere else. And let me just, I mean, as I listen to this today, it occurs to me that virtually everything could be done by the Secretary of State if that's the way we wanted to end up with it. I'm not suggesting that is the way we want to end up with it, but what's the thinking at this point about what the system after the transition is going to look like?
Yeah, that's a very insightful question, because you're exactly right. What the federal legislation does is that it places an enormous amount of authority and responsibility on the states. What I see our system looking like is that hopefully we'll be all optical scan in a few years, all optical scan in which you can use a pen, but you aren't required just to use a pencil, and that there's going to be technology available to help folks with disabilities, and that we're going to have a centralized voter registration system in which people have more confidence that people aren't registered to vote in more than one place. And I think there's going to be more public confidence in the integrity of our election system as a result of just those things. But we're also going to have an election system in which we do a better job of voter education and election worker education, and we're going to, you know, the election plan that we're all working on and developing is going to go into detail about exactly how we think that ought to be done. And by the way, there is a requirement in the bill that the plan has to go out for public comment. We can't just all get together in the back room and decide on it and then, you know, mail it in to the feds. So there has to be a public process involved, and that's built into our schedule.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, follow up.
Thank you. Will there still be a county elections office?
Yes.
So what will its function be?
Well, the county elections office will be, they can still register voters at the county election office. They'll be able to take your card and register you. They will still send out your ballots. They'll still count your ballots. All of that function will still reside with the county. We do not expect any of that to change.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart stole my question. Good thinking, Representative.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? Okay. Let's close the informational hearing on the Help Make America Vote Act and open a public hearing on House Bill 2145. And Mr. Lindback and Ms. Rozick, continue on.
Okay. House Bill 2145. So what you see in this bill, we refer to this as our fast-track bill. And that's because it has principally the provision that would create a state election fund as required by the bill. And then it provides the Secretary of State's office with the authority to establish the administrative complaint procedure, which we talked about in the overview. And it has a couple of other provisions in it. It allows the Secretary of State to receive ballots from those long-term and absentee electors. In other words, we will just establish ourselves as an office where we can receive that ballot and forward it to the appropriate county. And it also, under the bill adopted by the legislature on centralized voter registration, that state bill that was adopted last session had a deadline in it, and we in this bill adopt a deadline that conforms with the federal law. So those are the four major provisions of this bill. The administrative complaint procedure sections are included in some proposed amendments to the original bill that we submitted. And so I believe you should have those amendments in front of you as well as the bill.
Any questions? Representative Berger.
Yes, I'm not sure I quite understand the amendments. For instance, some of these are just a lot of ORS numbers, and I don't know what they mean. Can you just tell me in kind of a little summary why you have these amendments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I'd be happy to do that. I think Mr. Lindback explained in the overview that the concept that Congress had for this administrative complaint procedure was that it be a state-based informal procedure where people could register their concerns that some part of Title III of HAVA has not been complied with, and that the state work with people and the counties in order to provide some kind of remedy, which we conceive as being something went wrong or something is going wrong, let's fix it and move on. It was not intended to be a litigation process. And so what these amendments, particularly Section 8 and Section 9, do is draw out what I call the HAVA administrative complaint procedures and say that those procedures are going to be adopted by administrative rule, but they are not going to use other kinds of processes the Secretary of State already has on election law violations, which is the citation 263.45. That statute will not apply. And then Section 9 says that the administrative complaint procedures are not going to go through the Administrative Procedures Act as contested case procedures. They're not full-blown hearings. There's not plaintiffs and defendants or any of that sort of thing. They're to be an opportunity to investigate a situation, determine if there's been anything that's gone wrong, and if something has gone wrong, to adjust it, to provide a remedy. But no money will change hands. No one will be found guilty of anything. It's not that kind of a process. And so in order to make it clear that this doesn't fall into the definition under the APA of a contested case procedure, we're asking that specifically be noted so that we don't have any contention that we have to provide contested case procedures. We're trying to keep this an informal process that is not expensive for any party in the process. Those are what the statutes are. Really, Section 9 is simply the exemption that's down there in the bold at the very bottom, and that those statutes are the Oregon APA, the Administrative Procedures Act.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Close.
In Section 2, Lines 7 and 8, it says that the interest earned from the election fund shall be credited to the fund. I was just wondering if you're to get $48 million, which your one sheet showed, total for this state, or no, excuse me, 42, that would be approximately at 5%, $2 million. I'm wondering if that's common practice, Mr. Chair, that the interest from this type of account does not go into the general fund?
Your response?
Mr. Chair, Representative Close, that very language is required by the federal law. Our elections fund will not comply with federal law unless it keeps the interest. But the money will not come in front-ended and then sit there. It's going to come in over a period of years and probably be spent fairly shortly, transferred onto the counties or spent. I don't think it's going to be a matter of having that large chunk of money and having it sit there for years. But in fact, our elections fund will not comply with federal law unless the fund is allowed to keep interest. And that's why we needed the bill, because otherwise special funds, ordinarily the interest goes to the general fund.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also on Section 2, I believe it's Lines 10 and 11, the election fund shall consist of amounts appropriated or otherwise made available by the state legislative assembly or this state for carrying out the activities for which payments are made to this state. And so what is your anticipation that the legislatively approved funds would be?
Well, the parts of the some of the funding under this bill requires a 5% match by the state, and so any money that would be state matching money would need to go into the fund under the provisions of this act.
Anybody else? And I guess in that same Section 2, can you describe for me how the Secretary of State will have authority to appropriate funds, and how does that work with the Ways and Means process with the legislative oversight?
We were discussing that today. I think that's an issue still to be addressed in terms of at what point do we go to Ways and Means and at what point do we not. We're still trying to work that out in terms of what sort of legislative approval may be needed in order to spend money out of the fund or whether or not it's needed at all. I can't answer your question in any great detail today. We're trying to take this one step at a time. We can't accept any of the money until we get the fund created. And then we'll have to look at those issues when we see what sort of ties are placed on the money from the federal government and reconcile that against our own state laws.
Okay, I guess I'd take a different view. I think that we need to get that worked out with Ways and Means before we actually establish this, because the fact that the money is going to come in, there's going to be different strings attached to it, I'm sure, that we would all have to comply with. But I also believe that how that happens and where the funds ultimately go still should have legislative oversight, and I'm not willing to keep that question open until we're able to get that, then I think we can pass this out.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. It's been good information, and appreciate your help on that, Mr. Limbeck, Mr. Rozek. We do have additional testimony by Kathy Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the Government and Fiscal Policy Chair for the Legal Women Voters of Oregon. the League is a nonpartisan grassroots political organization which is very much involved with encouraging citizen participation in government, including elections, and providing voter education information. We are represented on the steering committee, as John alluded to. I happen to be that representative. We're very much interested in what the federal government is proposing for states to do to try to reform our election laws. While we have a good system in Oregon, it needs to be improved. I'm not going to belabor the point. You've heard about the plan, about the law. We're working on the plan. And what we're asking of you is that you expeditiously look at the legislation that comes before you with regard to implementing HAVA, and that if in fact you want to refer it to Ways and Means, we hope that you will consider passing it out for Ways and Means referral back to you, but that you don't sit on this for too long a time, because we feel it is very important to move the legislation along and establish the fund so that when and if the money comes to us. And the report we had at the steering committee last week was that Congress was looking to try to get that money into the omnibus bill that they're working on right now, so that we would know fairly soon how much we're getting. We probably won't get it until August or so, but we need to be ready to do that so we can move forward, because we do need a centralized voter registration, and we do need to take care of the punch card ballots. I live in a county that still has punch card ballots, and we're working with our county commissioners to move on that. They, in fact, have a March 31st deadline. The three counties that have punch card ballots, as I understand it, have a March 31st deadline to indicate their interest and need to move on doing something about that. So we in the League are certainly encouraging the three counties, Clackamas, Washington, and Lane, to have their commissioners move on getting their plans into the state about what they're going to do about this, even though they need help from the money that will come in under Title I.
Right. Any questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to publicly, for the record, thank Lane County Women, League of Women Voters, because in their interview and questions with candidates, they ask about this act, and it was the only question that I had to tell them I didn't know. And so they put it on my radar screen, and I came back and found out all about it, and then lo and behold, it's the first bill before the Rules Committee. So, Ms. Berzak, you were ahead of your time.
Thank you. Well, this is something that we have been hoping for a long time, and we're glad that it at least is on the horizon.
Mr.
Yes, Representative Close.
I'd like to ask a question. Is it Berzak?
No, she's Kathy Eaton.
No, I'm Kathy Eaton.
I'm sorry. I was just noticing on our materials here that this was passed the last day of October, so it's actually been less than 3 months since this was passed.
That's right.
I'm a little concerned that you want to implement this so quickly. Wouldn't you think it'd be wise to take a careful look at it before we...
We're just asking that you implement the implementation of it, which is to enact the elections fund. You will be receiving a very detailed state elections plan that we're working on now, which will be the implementation of all of the titles within HAVA. But right now, we want to have our elections fund established so that when the money is coming down to us, we will have the ability to accept it, because right now, unless we have that fund, we can't do anything with it. But no, that how the system will be implemented in Oregon is going to take a while. This is just simply the first phase in of that step, if you will. We would expect that we will have a state plan draft for you within the next 3 or 4 weeks. We've been working very hard on it to work out all of the things that we can, so that you'll know exactly how Oregon would like to implement the titles that are within that act. Does that answer your question, Representative Close?
My apologies for calling you the wrong name.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Probably see you again.
Yes. Look forward to it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Barton.
I just wanted to note that Cappy Eaton is a neighbor of mine right down the hill from where I live. I'm very, very pleased to see you here testifying on this important matter and the work that you and the League do in connection with things like this.
Thank you, Carol. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, and just, if I can bring Mr. Lynn back once more. You had indicated earlier the idea to fast-track this bill, and I wanted to get a sense from you the federal requirements on when we have to have this out and signed by the governor, and you know, obviously it's better to do it as soon as we can, but what kind of timeline deadlines are we against?
There was some news late last week that there was $1.5 billion put in the Senate version of an appropriations bill for just this fiscal year alone, and that could move fairly quickly. And there was an indication that, contrary to what the steering committee was told about not seeing money till August or September or October, that there could be some early money out of this process made available to the states sometime within the next 60 days. I think a reasonable time frame for us to work with this legislation is if we could get this to the governor's desk by March 1st, we should be fine. That would allow us to at least receive whatever early monies come from out of a piece of legislation like that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many states already have their general fund established? Do you know?
You know, not very many. Yeah, most of the session, most of the legislatures are just getting started, and I'm not sure any of them do. So we're
out front.
Well, you know, we're in the lead. We're in the lead on developing our plan as well. We like to be in the lead in Oregon.
Thank you. Well, committee, just so you know, I think we do have to resolve the one issue on the appropriations concept with the Secretary of State. As a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, since it is a joint Ways and Means committee, that the Ways and Means folks actually have the option to just approve it out of that committee and not go over to the Senate for additional committee work. So, you know, what I want to make sure is we get as much done as we can and make sure we're comfortable with it, knowing that it may have that kind of quick, fast-track kind of process on the Senate side. So, and we also anticipate there's going to be some additional folks coming in to testify on this, and we'll get that organized. I anticipate we'll have those all those answers and get the resolution of this probably next week and take it from there. So any other questions on that? All right. We'll close the public hearing on 2145. And anything else before the committee?
Members of the committee, we have a committee that meets in here at 3 o'clock, so if you could please leave your supplies at your spot, that would be helpful. Thank you. That's my only announcement.
All right. Thank you all for coming. We're adjourned.